You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
It's Thursday, 15 October. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from MoneyWeb Global Headquarters in Houghton, Johannesburg. On the show today, Viv Govender, markets and particularly U.S. bank results as they start to flow in. Keith McLachlan on equity versus consolidated holdings and the results and changes to the PSG IFRS details that are going to impact results. We're going to unpack all of that. Mark Brown on ETFs in South Africa, particularly seen as they are approaching their 20th birthday next month. Some morning headlines, MoneyWeb, the three-year rule for tax immigration sticks, and Business Day, Telkom seeks to reverse Vodacom Rain deal. Morning markets, the US was red overnight, S&P down 0.7%, NASDAQ off 0.8%. Asia, mixed, we got Sydney up 0.8%, and Tokyo off 0.6%. Commodities also mixed with PGMs under pressure, gold $1,901 an ounce, Rand 16.56 against the US dollar. And top 40 opening call, looking for a red open about 0.6% down.
MoneyWeb Now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting with Viv Govender, he's a portfolio manager at Rand Swiss. Viv, morning. I want to touch on those U.S. Banking results. Before I do, Famous Brands has finally put their gourmet burger kitchen into administration in the U.K. I suppose we saw it coming. This really is a sorry conclusion to what has been another failed offshore venture by a South African corporate. Our JSE is littered with these, and he has another one coming to a sticky end.
Most certainly. And I mean, there was a while when I had a thesis that, you know, the guys that went to the first world tended to do quite badly, but we had some successes in the third world, you know, the MTNs and the ShopRites and so on. Mm-hmm. But since, you know, the last little while, I mean, even the MTNs and the ShopRites haven't been as successful as I have thought. One thing I do fear is that, you know, there is more happening when it comes to, you know, companies trying to go to the first world than just pure business decisions. I think it is a case of lifestyle. I think it is a case of no ego for the management. Lifestyle in terms of, you know, having a spending part of a year in London or in Austria or in the US. And I know for a fact, I've actually spoken to some CEOs who have privately told me, smaller companies, not as big as Famous Brands, who have told me that they want to have that US operations as a almost an escape route, you know, for if they want to emigrate one day or something like that. But I do think there is that kind of aspect to it. But we have had very little success. The one like exception I would say was MTN, but even it has had problems with Nigeria and with Iran, which were at one time quite successful.
Yeah, you make a great point there. I mean, we Woolies went to Australia. That didn't work. A gourmet burger kitchen in the UK. I remember Discovery tried the US and lost $1 billion before they bailed out. But truthfully, the rest of the continent has not. I mean, I think Nigeria, Woolies failed there. Telkom
Tiger
failed
Brands. There.
Tiger Brands failed there. Xara failed there. I mean, I'm actually running out of time. I'm not running out of lists. I mean, you know, the answer is quite simple. If you own a stock and they move offshore, you're probably better off exiting.
Look, I mean, unless it's Naspers.
Fair point.
Effectively. Yeah. But look, I do think that it has been a... I'm not sure what it is. Maybe it's our arrogance. Maybe it's our... Like I said, maybe it is the fact that some of these things are not business cases, but they are ego or other, you know, driven cases. But yeah, recently we have not had much success with our overseas operations.
Let's move across to the US. Results season is out. The banking results have been coming out, the likes of JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs. And I got to say, they are knocking it out the park. I mean, it's very much a case of crisis. What crisis? They've bounced back and are looking immensely strong.
Yeah, well, some of them are. Bank of America, of sure. course, didn't do quite as well. Look, I do think it is a case of, you know, if you're in the right situation in this current time period, you will be doing reasonably well. I do suspect, however, that, you know, the more exposed you are to the direct you know, economy and you're not basically, you know, to this so much it was linked to or focused on the market, mm-hmm. and the more likely you are to be doing badly. The consumer himself is under pressure, or herself under pressure. I do think that we are going to be seeing knock-on effects of these lockdowns, especially like, I mean, there's places like California that still have quite strong lockdowns in place. You know, the US is a case of, you know, places like Florida, back to normal. California is still in major lockdowns. And I think that's going to have a huge impact in terms of just where your business is based. And like I said, if you are market-based and you are investment-based, almost nothing has happened to you. But if you are based on, you know, for instance, business loans or, you know, personal loans, you're going to be feeling quite some pain, I think, going through, especially when you factor in the fact that, you know, interest rates are so low. So your margins are low anyway.
Yeah, that's a fair point. And the point you make, I mean, these banks, it's not their sort of their client-facing business. It's their trading-facing business, which then brings me to the point, and Viv, we've discussed this before, stimulus package seems it's not going to happen anytime soon. You've made the point that it was, I mean, it was giant. It was absolutely significant. We forget that $600 is what 10,000 ZAR. A lack of a stimulus package, how much does that concern you in terms of the U.S. sort of recovering into the end of the year?
Look, I mean, it's turned out to be basically we need $1 trillion every couple of months for the U.S. economy to not be in a crisis. That seems to be the situation right now, because this wasn't the first, you know, trillion-plus dollar package that was pushed through. And it wouldn't be the last as well. It would have been a temporary measure that would have been renewed and renewed and renewed. Look, what I think the idea is, and this is pure politics, you know, people can argue the Democrats are the good guys, the Republicans are the bad guys, but generally these are just two bad guys. Just one of them has doesn't have a crazy man leading them. You know what I mean? That's the pretty much the case here. And the Democrats, I think, are willing to sacrifice people's well-being for the election advantage it gives them. They don't want to have people getting a $1,000 check coming into the mail from the U.S. government just as they're about to go to vote for the U.S. president or the Senate. They want people to feel bad about things. That's going to fuel a change. And I think that is one of the behind-the-scenes things here. Trump seems to be quite keen on a deal to be done. But I think it's not going to be likely before the election, unless he's losing by so much, unless Biden's lead is so dramatic, then, you know, the Democrats might just say, why not now? But I don't think it's going to be. First of all, I think this is not going to be the cure-all. $1 trillion package is huge, but not going to be a cure-all, or $2 trillion, depending on who you're talking to. And the second thing is that I do think it's going to be a case of after the election, the winners are all going to be quite keen to push the money through.
Yeah, but then suddenly we'll see it all coming. Viv Govender, Portfolio Manager at Rand Swiss, appreciate your early morning.
MoneyWeb now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
Training now with Keith McLachlan. You find him at Alpha Asset Management. And Keith's going to help us be smarter this morning because PSG put out a sense that bent our brains. Keith, morning. I suppose let's stand back before we get to PSG and understand equity versus consolidated accounting. And this is, if I'm correct, this is when a company owns another company, another business. And depending whether they own more or less than 50%, then defines how they incorporate this into their results as per IFRS.
Let's even step one step
sure.
Back. Yeah, and right in the background, we have something called International Financial Reporting Standards, mm-hmm. IFRS. And within IFRS, there are, for the same transaction, one can have accounting policies that differ that mean that you account for it differently. So what you're referring to is effectively IFRS 10. IFRS 10, 11, and 12, but mainly IFRS 10, where we talk about consolidation and effectively group accounting. So there's where a company has control over another company, and control itself has a definition. It's not always direct equity investments. You can, for example, control the board. The point being is you control the company. Typically speaking, you would consolidate that company in, either mm-hmm. completely or proportionally. Now, that's the typical way of doing it. What's happened at PSG is there is an exception within IFRS 10 versus consolidation and equity accounting where you're actually an investment entity. And in that case, you effectively fair value your investments and they go through on a mark-to-market basis for your income statement, which makes your income statement chaos.
Woo.
Your balance sheet, in fact, starts to become thin valued or I put this in inverted commas, fairly valued.
But I take your point around that chaos on the income statement and ultimately the results, because, let's take one example. Actually, there's a bunch. They own, PSG owns PSG Consult, Zeta, Cura, Stadio, Capitec. These are all listed. Are they going to have to then take the changes in share price from period to period through that income statement?
So the definition, once again, we're working with IFRS, the definition of fair value, where it's unlisted, starts to become challenging, and that becomes directly determined, and there's various assumptions and stuff that go into that. But in PSG's case, we have about 75.75% of its investments are in fact listed. So there's a hierarchy of ways to calculate fair value. The best way and the cleanest way is where it's a third-party determined fair value. In other words, a share price. So those share prices would have a mark-to-market and it would quite simply go through PSG's balance sheet.
And it does mean that when PSG results come out, we're actually going to have to dig deeper into them. That headline number we see, it might just be a case of that one of the shares was under pressure. It's not necessarily, share price is not always telling us that much about operational activity.
Well, the nice thing is because three-quarters is separately listed, we can, in fact, dig through those individual investments. So you can obviously build your own view of their fair value as well as the market value. Then, obviously, from a PSG perspective, the key disclosures won't necessarily be that. It will be what else they're doing. So we're talking the unlisted investments, where they're applying capital. Are they buying back shares? What is the cost of their head office? Because, obviously, the present value of the holdco investment entities overhead structure, you got to really become the discount against this NAV. And by the way, that is the one thing that's very relevant that does flow through the income statement. So one has to pull that out in order to determine not just what the balance sheet or the NAV is worth, but after a discount, what the actual share might be.
Yeah, okay, gotcha. Okay, so PSG results are going to become a whole different, and they warned us in the sense, we're going to have to get smarter about that. Quickly before I let you go, Coronation, a stock which I know me and you both like, we both hold it. Trading update yesterday, I thought not a bad update. They're looking about 10 to 20% up in HEPS, assets under management, flattish, which over the last quarter suggests that maybe there was still a little bit of outflow, but 10 to 20% up in HEPS, I thought that was a good number.
Absolutely. A little better than I expected. I expected basically flat to 10% up. But we're looking at a period of chaos in the market, and I do think on the balance, most of Coronation's funds were quite well positioned, which obviously helps their NAV, helps their AUM. And then you have really a company with a very large amount of variable costs in it. So meaning that its bottom line is actually a lot more stable than people realize. So I thought those are great results. Given Coronation's very attractive dividend policy, we would expect dividends to track that profit growth upwards as well.
Yeah, and they pretty much pay out almost all of their HEPS as dividend, and it puts them on a very chunky dividend yield. We'll leave that there. Keith McLachlan, fund manager at Alpha Asset Management, helping us be smarter around IFRS and what's going to be the impact to those PSG results. Keith, appreciate the time.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
Chatting now with Mike Brown, no relation. He's managing director ETF SA. Mike, morning. Appreciate your time. I want to talk third quarter stats from ETPs in South Africa. Before I get to that, we're coming up to the 20th anniversary of our first ETF on the JSE. You were there. You were running Satrix at the point. It was that Satrix 40 ETF. You must look back over that. And I mean, I imagine at the time you thought you were onto something good, but I mean, it really has. I mean, ETFs have absolutely taken off in this country and truthfully empowered, I was going to say hundreds of thousands of private investors to get really simple, easy exposure into the market.
Yes, it has been quite a success story. It's a, even in those days when we launched Satrix 40 in November 2000, ETFs were really just starting in America and elsewhere, but I think a massive success around the world. I think about 70% of all retail money in America now goes into ETFs for investment and not into unit trusts and single shares and things like that. So I think it's not quite as big as that, but we're doing quite well in South Africa. As you can see from our last quarterly survey of the industry, the total ETP industry in South Africa is now worth 112 billion rand, and that's up from 100 billion rand at the end of last year. So there's been quite a nice increase in the size of the industry during the first 9 months of this year.
Yeah, and 112 billion, that's a big number. But if we compare it to US numbers, if we compare it to the unit trust industry in South Africa, it's truthfully still a very long way to go. I mean, this number could have an extra zero on the end, and it would probably only then be in line.
I think that's correct. I think, you know, essentially what we're finding globally is that ETFs are bought by retail investors, and the retail investor universe in South Africa is quite small. I mean, you know, most people rely on financial advisors to bring them products and things like that, and they typically prefer unit trusts and other products which have got much higher cost structures and allow for bigger commissions and things like that. But as more and more gets known about ETFs and how efficient they are and how easy they are to trade in, and you can just buy them online and different platforms and so on, I think we'll start seeing further growth. So the first 20 years has been interesting. I have written the history of the first 20 years, which I'm bringing out quite soon, so perhaps we can talk a bit about that later in the year. But I think the next 20 years will be even more exciting.
Yeah, they are. And I mean, we've had some great innovations. One of them, obviously, tax-free accounts, what, some 5 years ago. But the one point you make in your report is that, you know, 70% of that market capitalization is now actually foreign referenced equity. In other words, the offshore and commodity. And that's one of the beauties of it. And I remember 10, 20 years ago, trying to get offshore exposure was more than a headache. It just frankly wasn't worth the effort in many cases. Now it is a case of, you know, I can log on and I can buy Japan, I can buy the US, I can buy gold and platinum, and that now is sort of almost three quarters of that 112 billion market capitalization.
That's very true. So, I mean, you know, the big issue with ETFs is back in 2015, the Foreign Exchange Control Authority, the Southern Reserve Bank, allowed inward investments, which said that if you have a feeder fund listed offshore, you can list in the JSE, and then people can invest in that fund, even though it's foreign reference, without any sort of exchange control implications and so on and so forth. So it's much easier to buy a foreign reference ETF or even a commodity ETF from the JSE than take your money offshore, pay a lot of money for that, end up having an international manager charging your fortune to manage your money as a non-resident and so on. So that's a concession to allow inward invested ETFs onto the JSE, I think, is very important. And I think that's where the real growth has been in ETFs in the last few years, is people buying US global indices and themed type ETFs easily and simply on the JSE rather than having to go offshore. And so I see that as being a big area of growth coming forward. And one of the things that was launched as recently are ETNs, exchange traded notes, just on single stocks.
Mm-hmm.
They come in just too late for this report. I think they were listed on the 1st of October. But now you can buy an ETN on the JSE where you can invest in Tesla or Microsoft or Apple or any of those, Alphabet, Amazon, any of those companies, just by buying a note on the JSE, and that gives you access to those international companies, both in dollars and in rands. You can choose whether you want to buy it in dollars, in other words, to be denominated in dollars, or you want it to be denominated in rands. So these, in effect, have now become depository receipts to enable people to trade in not only the indices, but now single stocks. So that's the area of development, is, I think, in the offshore access to international markets, using ETFs and ETNs.
Yeah, we chatted to Peck Mkhize last week about those from First Rand, and I agree with him. That's a great innovation. I can now buy Apple on the JSE, absolutely no problem at all, and a whole bunch of other of those tech stocks. We'll leave that there. Mike Brown, Managing Director, ETFSA. Appreciate your early morning time. That's it for today. You'll find us live every weekday morning, 6:30 a.m. on the MoneyWeb website or the app. Podcast available from 7 o'clock on the website, the app, or wherever good podcasts are aggregated. Chat to us on the social medias using hashtag MoneyWebNow. A massive thanks to my team, Eddie Cordora and Masekhla, to you for listening, my guests for their early morning contributions. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.